Crutches Used as a Weapon by Matthew Derby. 1. We are field testing the new snow. I am waiting at the summit, pressing the binoculars into my eye sockets, training them on the cloud ship in the distance. Go ahead, I say into the speech bead. Let it snow. I have been waiting to say this. Instead of laughter in the receiver, or even a slow, empty grunt, I hear only static. Room noise. The sound of hot drinks being poured out into paper containers. Sure enough, though, the snow starts to come. Great sheets of it pouring out of the belly of the cloud like taffy. Number F, come in. It is the minister. Yes, your royalty-ness, your highness. Yes, sir. What does the machine say, son? I take a look at the machine. It is not moving. Well, sir, it doesn't appear to be saying anything just yet. The cloud approaches swiftly, laying out a carpet of dense snow about a mile and a half wide. When the snow falls on the trees, some of them break in half. The minister does not respond. Instead, I hear the scraping of a stylus on a slate pad. Son, the minister says after a time. Yes, sir? How close are you to the snow? I do not respond to the minister, because the snow is already here. The cloud drapes a massive coat of it, about 3 feet thick, right on top of the machine, and then me. Son? Son? I can hear the minister calling through the speech bead, but I can no longer move my arm to lift the bead to my face. 2. We lost our daughter in the new mall. Condescendingly over-designed and implemented, it seemed the last place a person could disappear into. The wide, carpeted aisles and glass panels appeared to us as massive receptacles, built to draw us in and protect us, channeling us along from one store to the next in a carefully forethought pattern. What purpose could those sleek neon balustrades, the swatches of unbelievably bright primary color faux tribal murals and forking multi-tiered fountains serve but to deflect tragedy and grief? It was incomprehensible that a body could find its way through this halcyon barricade, and yet we managed, somehow, to misplace her. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that we put her in a place from which it became increasingly difficult for her to return. I may have let go of her hand hours before we discovered she was gone. It was hard to tell in that place, immersed as we were in the flow of bodies around the center spire, the puffed, flared cylinder of canvas that brought a centrifugal force to the structure. The one thing I remember clearly was the leering orange clown face that topped a public trash barrel, into the gaping mouth of which a thin, gauzy woman had just inserted a foam tray heaped with a family's worth of crumpled tissue paper and crushed drink cups. Our daughter feared clowns, so I was bending down to shield her from the looming bust when I realized she was not there at all. That the weight I'd been interpreting as her body tugging away at my arm had been nothing but two overstuffed plastic bags. I looked up at Karen, who put as much of her fist into her mouth as she could, as if to bite it off might somehow stanch the delirious onset of panic. We paced to the center court in ever-widening arcs, peering wildly into the storefront display windows, because the logic seemed to be to look in the crevices, the dark, hushed rooms, the most obvious places, would be to cheapen the disappearance, to disrespect it. We took turns shouting her name, hands cupped to our mouths to channel the sound out over the heads of the passing crowds, the word as it broke away from our faces seeming only to rise and disperse flaccidly into the complex, fluorescent web above, bringing down the noise level, as if one's voice could sweep a room clean of sound. We found an orange jacket, a beefy, wedge-shaped white woman who took us into a small, low room. "Could you describe the child?" she asked, situating herself in a small, yellow plastic chair. I took the first stab. She was like this, I said, holding my arms out to my sides. When she walked, it was like this, Karen said, walking around in a circle, hunched over slightly, taking small steps on the balls of her feet. And when she opens her mouth, you always think she's going to spit something up, but words come out instead. She hates fruit, Karen added. The woman looked at us for a long time. Then she tried to sketch a picture of the child using the information we'd given her. When she was done, she passed it across the table to us. Keep in mind, it's not going to be perfect. But it was perfect. Horrifyingly so. I understood, for the first time, perhaps, how erroneous the statement, "I felt empty," was. What I felt was full. I brimmed impossibly with wild, sputtering dread. Karen sat, folded like a paper crane, in the corner. The office was actually called Loss Prevention. "Don't panic," the woman said. "We haven't even begun a formal search." "After that, we can start panicking?" Karen asked. The woman did not respond, only wrapped the sketch in burlap and ushered us out into a waiting room. 2. Part 2. We watched ourselves on the security monitors while men in light blue uniform tops patrolled the dense arteries of the showroom floors, looking for signs. I paced restlessly, purposefully, aware of my body's participation in a larger, more historically significant pacing, convinced that, given the chance, I could lure the child back into our lives, using my body as a probe, a divining rod. As the day failed, predictably, to do anything but insinuate itself into night, though, my will gave way to a sort of frenzied inertia, which crested as the guards ushered the last shoppers from the floor with gentle static prods, and bottom out at about 2 a.m. as a dim, flickering fear. The first thing I dreaded was that my daughter would not return, but in barely perceptible stages I realized that what I was more afraid of was that the child would return. I did not want to have to endure the moment of painful, awkward reconciliation when the girl, rescued from the precipice of some sprawling ventilation unit or the cargo hold of a chalk-blue van driven by some swarthy, toothless parolee, would run towards us, bruised, bandaged arms outstretched, wholly unaware of how easily and confidently we'd lost her. It would be, for everyone else who witnessed, the families at home watching the moment replayed in slow motion on a screen behind the slick, rotund visage of a harried anchorwoman, a shameful riot of light and motion that could not be erased. I imagined how the scene would play itself out as seen from the observation camera through the choppy blue monitors mounted on the opposite wall of the waiting room. Who were we loping into the periphery of the camera's gaze? We were not parents. We were patrons. Members. Enthusiasts. 2. Part 3. At some point during the night, I took a magazine to the restroom. It was a women's magazine, the kind with multiple-choice personality tests that determine one's outlook on life by how many points one accrued by responding a certain way. One of these tests had been filled out. I recognized Karen's hooked, cramped pen work in the arithmetic, the way she crossed her sevens, especially, as if someone could mistake a seven for... what? The results of the test were meant to indicate what type of woman the subject was. The last thing I wanted to know was what the test had to say about how little my wife trusted her own perceptions. So I closed the magazine and fitted it, folded in half, in the orifice of the conical tissue dispenser. The lead article in the magazine: Crutches Used as a Weapon. At 4:30, they let us out. "Most children are located within 72 hours, they told us. Again, we were told not to panic. We trudged numbly through the cavernous green parking garage, motivated only by the desire to anchor ourselves to the house, barricade ourselves from the ugly new life we'd inadvertently created. In the car, Karen said one thing. Her hand, the way it... Her lower lip listed and shook, threatening to give way. "I'm already forgetting. You don't forget it's... I said. I gripped her thigh reassuringly. It's not a thing you forget. 3. They dig me out of the snow. Jesus, Hot Brian says. This snow sucks. It's terrible, says Penalty. It's like a white rubber quilt. I can't see, I tell them. I've told them before that I couldn't see, which is why they don't respond in any way. But this time, I really can't see. Not even tiny pinpricks of light or patches of color. Let's get the hell out of here, they say. If we don't get real snow to happen soon, we will all lose our jobs. We should never have told those guys we could make snow, Penalty says, as they lift me onto the bed of what I can only imagine to be a helicopter truck. Yeah, that was real stupid. What were we thinking, Hot Brian says. I can feel them strapping my body down with nylon cords. Next time, chaps, I say, into an undefined cube of air directly above my head. One of them, I can't tell which, pats me gently on the head. They are mouthing words to each other, I can tell. Their lips smack noisily, working out the specifics of some plan involving, I am sure, my dismissal from the project. The vehicle lurches. We are in the air, churning upward toward the cloud. 4. Immediately, and without forethought, I started telling lies about where I'd been on the day we lost our daughter. I was surprised at how easily I could modify my life, and how readily my parents, my brother, my co-workers, accepted the new person I had become. The more people I lied to, in fact, the further away from that Sunday afternoon and everything I did, and perhaps more important, what I did not do, I became. So that, presumably, one day the whole 4 years I had spent as a father might successfully and completely be excised, like raw footage. This has not happened yet. Karen stayed in the house, slaughtering whole hours huddled in one position. I'd call her up from the summit every few minutes on my speech bead to hear what she saw through the bedroom window. There's a man in a yellow shirt, she'd say, softly, into the pale blue lozenge, as if I were in the room with her. Oh, he's just now turned the corner. 4. Part 2. Bedtime became a misnomer. It was no longer a point one got to in a day, but something grueling one put in for. A lengthy trail along which we lumbered, one hand still holding the last light of the previous day, while the other reached out for light that had not yet struck. 5. When I am not out on the summit with the machine, I work on the basement floor of a converted warehouse in the revitalized district, sketching out different kinds of snowflakes. The people who are paying us want the snow to be as real as possible, which means that each snowflake should be different from all the rest. But so far, I have not even come close. I keep drawing the same snowflake. My waste bin is filled with sketches of identical snowflakes. Because of our proximity to the sea, with its erratic tide, the basement often floods, so our desks are balanced carefully on tall stilts. We sway pleasantly as we work, threading our sketches into a wide data cauldron in the center of the room. On the days of flooding, the water laps gently against the cauldron so that when we close our eyes during nap time, some of us have dreams in which we lie in the sand at the edge of a warm, triumphant body of water, resting our heads on a dense patch of ferns. Ruth sits at the desk directly ahead of me. She is trying to make the snow fall more gingerly. I keep motion sickness at bay by concentrating on the symmetry of her back, how her shoulder blades really do resemble the graceful wings of a butterfly. I never look for too long, though, because when I look for too long, she turns and smiles courteously, her stretchy, made-up face bundled in a burgundy kerchief. She smiles the condescending smile of a woman who is aware of someone's eyes have been drawing themselves across her entire body, and this is always the worst thing to have to see. 6. By springtime, when the solid clouds came and hung their bold, craterous heads over our sector, snapping plastic satellite dishes from the rooftops down our street and breathing hot, sooty panels of wind into every open corridor, Karen and I had already started to make a habit out of steering clear of the house. The rooms cast an alarmingly bright light at all hours, giving us double vision and trembling fits. The hallway leading to the girls' bedroom was especially bright. Light seemed to spring from the walls and floor in fiery waves. It was exhausting, even, to sit completely still for long periods. Put another, less fidgety way, the house would not allow us to grieve. We stayed away for as long a period of time as we could manage, loitering in multiplex theater lobbies, sneaking from film to film like children. Anything to put us off the inevitable return to the place where we lived. One night, sitting in the third row for a film we had already been to earlier in the day, Karen said, "You know, the thing I'm most ashamed of is that what I really miss about her are the things that everyone misses. The sound of her feet clapping on the linoleum in the morning. I long for that. I die inside every time I think of it. And I die again just knowing that someone else in an office building somewhere deep in the city could predict that I would feel that way years ago, probably before I was born, and make a commercial about it. I feel like someone has already anticipated my life. I want to feel something new. I want my own feelings." In the sour green light of the trailer advisory, her face appeared translucent, beautiful. I realized the sort of jurisdiction she had shown over her own emotions, and I felt myself start to sink away from her because of it. My own feelings were as crudely hewn as cave paintings, a child's tentative stab at the human form, what they called a cephalopod. No matter how hard I tried to fudge the numbers, everything came down to a constant preoccupation with the status of my dick. 7. It was Karen's idea to start the garden. I felt it dishonest somehow. As if, as a result of our failure to guide a small person through even the most rudimentary social acts, walking, for instance, we should be forbidden the responsibility of ushering on any life at all. But Karen was of the mindset that we should start small and work our way up, that our real mistake was in starting with such an enormous thing when we had never really taken note of the smaller ones. The plants that grew were not the ones on the packages. We could not recognize any of the wild, colorful flowers that shot up from the harsh dirt we'd tilled with a single, stolen, rusted hoe. The flowers were long and wispy. They gave off great clouds of orange pollen, which attracted strange yellow insects we'd never seen before, long-legged creatures with dark, knowing eyes. They gathered on the padded surface of the flowers and drank, making a faint whirring sound. It was a beautiful garden, but not the one we'd wanted. Not the one we'd envisioned in the store, thumbing through stacks of shiny seed envelopes. Knowing this, we tended the area obsessively and to exhaustion. Then the clouds passed over, covering the flowers with dense ash. They looked like gaunt black snowmen. Then they died. 8. I suppose you've been waiting for this. It is the minister, calling me from his office at the other end of the complex. He wants me to visit him. When I visit him, he will tell me to pack my things into boxes and leave. I suppose that it is what I have been waiting for, I say, barely paying attention, just skimming the real content of this discussion. I already know I am off the snow project. I have stopped drawing snowflakes altogether and have been submitting drawings of my own hand instead. I wrote "hand sandwich" on one I submitted into the data cauldron. The next day it appeared on my desk with the word "heh" written in red pen in the margin. I thought that perhaps they'd gotten the joke. "Where are you going?" Ruth asks as I descend the ladder from my desk. "This is it," I say, trying to sound as small and hurt as possible, even though what I feel is a sort of dull satisfaction. "No more snowflakes?" Never were snowflakes, if you really think about it. I'm never going to see you again. Nope. She turns back to her work. Then she turns around again. Wait, she says. I'll walk with you. We don't go to the office. Instead, I lead her into the network chamber. She holds onto my arm, just above the elbow, with both trembling, fussy hands. I don't remember being in here before, she says. Whenever I think of you for long enough, I say, we tend to end up in here. Oh, she says. It is dark in the chamber, and humid. Periodic gusts of wind burst through the corridor where we stand, rustling her long, wiry hair as if it were a fancy straw hat. I tell her I do not want to do the thing that we are about to do. Isn't it a little too late for that? She asks, hoisting a leg up onto the steel railing. Her heel gets caught in the grating so that the whole shoe comes off her foot and tumbles over the edge into the blackness. Damn, she says, and then, taking the other one off, might as well lose them both. No use for a single shoe. We listen to them ricochet off the sides of the deep cavity. She pulls herself close to me, pressing my face into her neck. She smells like a false human, the way another sort of creature would assume a human smells. Her presence is as brutal and unyielding up close as I've imagined, but there is also something else I haven't anticipated. A tender spot, a bruise she lets me finger and press with my whole body. She is not the kind of person I imagined would allow this sort of discourse. As she clings to me, I can feel some of myself going away, as if my body were suddenly nothing more than a decanter, and I could pour myself out entirely, spoil someone else's life with my own dank, ruinous indecision. Afterward, she returns to her desk, barefoot. I start down toward the office of the minister. My hands are trembling, so much so that I can barely open the door. 9. We were at the theater again. The film we were watching was turgid. It shimmied before us like a block of dead flesh, the ruminative characters inside little more than blurred slivers of darkness. A couple sat behind us. The woman said, I've been getting really good at closing my eyes through the whole movie. Karen did something with her face that might, in another time, have passed for a smile. They'd often take trips together, Karen and the girl, and in celebration of their return I'd hide a small toy or some candy somewhere in the house. The child would carefully investigate each room, carefully lifting, nudging, drawing back the fabric of the furniture until she find the tiny wrap package. Later, though, sometimes days later, I'd find her sitting on the floor right near the place where I had hidden the surprise, waiting for something else to show up. I thought it odd then, but there in the theater, studio logo looming on the screen, I realized that the girl was only training herself for a lifetime of disappointment, the way we huddle close to the people we know best, waiting for something of what we first felt for them to make a new appearance. 10. The solid clouds have moved on, briefly. Rather, they were carried off, toted at the end of long ropes by the nighttime dirigibles. It may be the way our eyes have adjusted to such things, but it looks very much as though a part of the sky had been removed as well. I am looking for work, assuming, each morning, that somewhere there is work waiting to be found. Karen has been learning to play the piano ever since the disappearance. It's the only thing that will make my fingers quiet enough, she says, filling the room with the soft, hesitant tones of a consummate beginner, the notes engorged with enthusiasm and shame. Over the months, she's gotten quite good. When I told her about Ruth, she went straight to the piano. Now Ruth is gone, too, off somewhere in another city, taking on someone else's slippery desperation. Karen and I sit together on the hard piano bench in the afternoon, I have learned the high parts, and she has learned the low parts. Most of the time, what we are playing is only barely discernible as music. When we know what we are doing, though, we smile quietly and briefly at the resultant song, stuffing the expression back down into our chests before it has exposed us for the people we always had a feeling we'd turn out to be.